In this episode, the United States Bankruptcy Appellate Panel of the Ninth Circuit hears argument in Inri Williams, an appeal from a bankruptcy adversary proceeding. At the heart of the case is whether a 20-year delay in pursuing a discharge determination for a fraud judgment can bar the claim under the doctrine of lashes, and whether the accrual of more than $600,000 in statutory interest on that judgment constitutes the kind of prejudice that makes lashes available. The underlying judgment stems from a 2002 fraud finding against the debtor, who later filed for bankruptcy without listing the debt. The creditor, Thaddeus Williams, renewed the judgment periodically under state law but took no enforcement steps for two decades. Williams has since passed away, and his successors in interest now seek to establish that the debt cannot be discharged. The bankruptcy court granted summary judgment to the debtor on lashes grounds, finding that the enormous interest burden coupled with the delay was inherently prejudicial. The appellants argue that statutorily mandated interest can never, as a matter of law, constitute prejudice for purposes of an equitable defense like lashes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please excuse me. I'm a little bit hoarse this morning. May it please the court.
Counsel for the appellants, the successors in interest to Thaddeus Williams, now begins the argument seeking reversal of the summary judgment dismissal.
Ray Ayers of Sanders Roberts on behalf of appellants Candace and Christopher Charles Williams, successor in interest to Thaddeus Williams, who is deceased, unfortunately.
Would you like to reserve a little time?
I would. I'd like to reserve 7 minutes.
7 minutes. You got it. Okay, thank you.
And I know there are a lot of facts here and a lot of issues. I think it boils down to a couple of big ones, but I'm happy to answer questions to make sure we focus on the questions that the court has rather than just repeating arguments.
You know, we're starting to sound like the Supreme Court, where the advocates now give about 2 minutes and then, you know, Justice Thomas goes off. So thank you.
In our view, Your Honor, this case boils down to whether judgment interest constitutes prejudice for purposes of lashes.
Lashes is an equitable doctrine that bars a claim when the plaintiff has unreasonably delayed in asserting it, and that delay has prejudiced the defendant. Unlike a statute of limitations, which sets a fixed deadline, lashes requires a fact-specific analysis. Was the delay inexcusable, and did it change the defendant's position for the worse? Courts apply it in contexts where no statutory deadline applies or where equity demands a flexible standard. The party asserting lashes bears the burden of proving both unreasonable delay and resulting prejudice.
The court here found that it does. We submit that as a matter of law, it does not, because judgment interest is a feature, not a bug, as we mentioned. And as part of the panel knows, In re Hamilton held that very same thing, that it's not just to incentivize the debtor to pay. It's also to compensate the victim of the fraud. So here, there was never anything paid on the fraud judgment. And we think that the court's ruling would be a perversion of the equity that lashes is supposed to provide, in that it would allow the debtor who didn't list the debt, who paid no money, to delay and claim financial hardship or the passage of time to avoid payment entirely. Meanwhile, the harmed party has passed away during the course of this proceeding. So in our view, Your Honors, the right outcome should have been a summary judgment in favor of the appellants, because lashes as a matter of law cannot constitute.
There's two issues here. One, lashes is a very fact intensive determination. So it's extremely rare, if impossible, to make that determination on a summary judgment motion, right?
We thought it certainly would be here as to the debtor who had the laboring oar on that issue as an affirmative defense. Here, we do think it would have been appropriate for appellants because even though it's
because you're saying there's no prejudice as a matter of law, there's no prejudice.
Correct.
Prejudice even with the delay because interest in it, accrual of interest is not prejudice.
Exactly. Right. As far as I know, all the 50 states and the federal government require interest. It's a public policy. It's in the California Constitution. The court noted in In Re Hamilton when it decided that the court could not reduce the interest because it thought that the interest was too high, the court here went even further and said, I'm going to use my equitable authority not just to reduce the interest rate or change the future interest. I'm going to eliminate the debt entirely. And we think that's wholly inappropriate use of the latches power.
Right. Let me back up a little bit even farther. Because let's talk about latches. Now, we have the Beatty case, which says that latches can be applicable in a 523A3B.
Section 523 of the Bankruptcy Code lists debts that are not discharged even after a bankruptcy is concluded. Subsection A3B prevents discharge of a debt that was not listed on the debtor's bankruptcy schedules in time for the creditor to file a proof of claim. Subsection A2 covers debts for fraud, and subsection A4 addresses fiduciary fraud. Subsection A6 deals with willful and malicious injury. These are among the narrow categories Congress decided should survive bankruptcy, and the creditor must prove the elements in an adversary proceeding, a lawsuit within the bankruptcy case.
Case, which is what this is with respect to the claims of A2, 4, and 6, fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, and malicious injury. But the court made a sweeping determination that it also applies to your 523A19 claim.
That was a secondary issue.
We've got some worries about the summary judgment aspect of this. Please address those for us.
So it does, in his declaration, say that this will create a financial strain on him. Whether that needs to be fully, we need to have a full trial or evidentiary hearing on that issue, then that would be the issue that needs to go to trial. Was there prejudice that was caused?
Here we are.
But I think that we have an absolute change of position, a substantial change of position. $600,000 of interest that is accrued from an individual that filed for bankruptcy. We know that he is an advanced age. The judge has observed him under examination, where both counsel had the ability to do that. He makes those observations, and
could be a finding of fact, right?
So does
that's
it,
great if you have a trial.
So
right?
Is it reversible error if he saw that? Because he's going to see the same thing again. He's going to see this individual.
Doesn't he have to, in summary judgment, take all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-movement? Isn't that just part of the summary judgment process?
It is. And that's why I go back and say the amount, as the court said, the amount of time plus the amount of interest that accrued is prejudicial. It is a changed circumstance from where he was in 2002 to where he is when this adversary proceeding gets filed in 2023. It is a significant.
That sounds, again, to my point, that sounds like prejudice on collection, right? Not the dischargeability. And the state of California said that those creditors who renew can't continue to collect. It's not prejudicial under state law, clearly, right? Because the debt is still out there. There is no time limit saying you cannot renew after that period, which we're here in. So why is it prejudicial for discharge purposes?
I think it's prejudicial just under the standard
because it's a lot of money
of latches, right? So latches just says.
But if I had known, I would have paid it more. I paid it earlier.
Absolutely. If you know that you have a debt,
but your client didn't know he had a debt and he didn't do anything. Because of latches.
No, because he thought it got discharged in his bankruptcy.
When a court enters a money judgment, state law typically requires that interest accrue on the unpaid balance at a statutory rate until the judgment is satisfied. In California, The rate is 10% per year. This interest compensates the prevailing party for the time value of money and the delay in payment. A judgment creditor can renew the judgment every 10 years to keep it alive as a lien and to continue accruing interest. The debtor argues that decades of accruing interest at this rate constitutes a change in circumstances. The appellants counter that interest is a legal incident of the judgment, not a form of prejudice.
But maybe it didn't. And he didn't give notice.
And doesn't he have the same right to file a lawsuit to get this determined, because he knows his brother's out there, you know, wanting to collect, and that money is accruing?
No, I don't know that the evidence shows that his brother wanted to collect.
He renewed it. Isn't that, again, on summary judgment, wouldn't it be a reasonable inference that if a creditor continues to renew a judgment, for summary judgment at least, there was an intent or desire to continue to collect?
I think that the evidence also shows that he believed the judgment, or the judgment was discharged when he filed an opposition to the renewal in 2020.
But I mean, the worry here, not to interrupt you, is that it kind of sounds like we're weighing a bunch of stuff, which doesn't sound like summary judgment to us.
I think it came down to the unreasonable delay coupled with the amount of interest.
Yeah, and any of those work for our purposes, okay? I mean, we're worried that what happened here is there was some weighing, there was some credibility determinations, which are off the table at summary judgment.
Well, I think latches is a abuse of discretion, and I think that the courts have.
Yeah, and had
summary judgment review is de novo.
Yes. But no,
that's where we are.
No, I think that whether it applies is de novo, but whether latches was the finding of latches was appropriate is an abuse of discretion. It's whether or not it should have been applied, whether it could be applied. That's what's de novo. But the application of it, that is discretion. That's an abuse of discretion.
We're talking about Rule 56. We're talking about everything in Rule 56.
Summary judgment is granted when no genuine dispute of material fact exists, and the moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. On appeal, the court reviews the grant or denial of summary judgment de novo, applying the same standard the trial court used. When latches is at issue, appellate courts use a hybrid standard. Whether latches is available as a defense to a particular kind of claim is reviewed de novo, but the application of latches to undisputed facts is typically reviewed for abuse of discretion. The parties here dispute which standard governs the question of whether interest can ever constitute prejudice.
56 is de novo. I just am not.
I think that it says. The courts apply a hybrid standard of review to grants of summary judgment on the basis of latches. Certain aspects of the district court's decision are reviewed de novo, including whether latches is available as a potential defense to a particular kind of action, and whether the district court inappropriately resolved and disputed material facts in reaching its decision. But the application of the latches doctrines to the facts is reviewed for abuse of discretion. So I think
it's. I would assume that there's no dispute. Disputed facts,
right.
According to your standard. All right, go ahead.
And the undisputed fact is that there is a 20-something year delay with $600,000 worth of interest that is accrued. That is now this man that believes it's discharged is suddenly saddled with. And I think that is extremely prejudicial.
Well, suddenly is reading an awful lot into it, but go ahead.
What's that?
Suddenly is reading an awful lot into this situation, but you go ahead.
Well, if you don't believe that you owe this money.
We're talking about belief here, okay? How is that possibly relevant for summary judgment? He believes one thing, the other side believes something else. You try the issue, you get witnesses on there, you believe one, you don't believe the other, you resolve it. How does that possibly fit within summary judgment?
I think that
I'm not trying to be funny. That's the challenge we have. We're trying to figure that out.
And I guess the difficult part that I find is that when I look at this and I'm sitting there seeing, how is this amount of debt, which is a substantial amount of money.
No doubt.
Right?
No doubt.
All of a sudden, you're in your later years, and it's now you're now liable for something that you did not think was that you were liable. So you made no plans, no retirement plans or you didn't in your planning for your retirement. You didn't plan for that, and all of a sudden you got to pay it. I think that is
that's why either party can bring the action to the court's attention. Either party can file the action to determine dischargeability. The problem, as my colleague is saying, is both parties have a belief that is inherently opposite.
And they could have brought that complaint.
You could have, right? Yeah.
You're right. Any party could have, but there wasn't. And they're the ones that are trying to collect on this debt. Without really doing anything, like enforcement actions for this very long period of time. And then when a actual action is taken, there is a dispute of that. So, you know, had it been done before, he's sitting on his rights. There's no judgment debtor examination. There's none of this other stuff that would have said, hey, this guy is really coming after me to enforce a judgment. I need to file an adversary proceeding. This is a family dispute. There's all kinds of stuff that is going on there. And I think that it's for him to have had the burden of bringing an adversary proceeding doesn't negate, or the fact that he could have does not negate the fact that the appellant didn't bring one, and that we're 23 years later, and we have this huge sum of money that is due.
Okay, about a minute over, so unless you have one last brilliant remark, I think we'll move on. Move back to the
remarks.
Well, you have. I mean, you're both on a wonderful job. Okay,
thank you
very much.
So I'll just briefly deal with the A19 issue. We think Irigoyen clearly lays out the standard there. I disagree respectfully with counsel's analysis. We think that this panel's uniquely qualified to be able to determine what Irigoyen stands for with respect to the need for dischargeability proceeding for A19.
Section 523, A19, makes non-dischargeable certain debts for the violation of federal or state securities laws, or for common law fraud, deceit, or manipulation in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. The parties touch on a separate question, whether a creditor relying on that subsection must bring an adversary proceeding to establish non-dischargeability, or whether the debt is automatically accepted. The argument references a Ninth Circuit decision addressing that procedural issue, though it appears ancillary to the main Lashes dispute here.
With respect to Lashes under A3B, we do agree that it is available in very limited circumstances. And I was thinking, as I was listening to counsel, it reminded me of a Seinfeld episode where George Costanza said, "It's not a lie if you believe it." And to me, it seems pretty crazy that the debtor's subjective belief that he doesn't owe the money means he doesn't owe the money. That just seems Kafkaesque to me. We don't think that.
Well, could you conclude that no jury could reasonably believe that?
Absolutely.
That's the point. Okay.
That's my point. And that's the other issue here is there shouldn't be going back to why is this judgment not enforced? This gentleman had a home in Del Mar, California worth almost $2 million. I have a declaration in the record that I submitted because I had it appraised. I got a litigation guarantee before we went to foreclose. The house was in an irrevocable trust in his daughter's name. His other brother was the trustee and put it back into his name in 2019. So the idea that Mr. Thaddeus Williams, who doesn't have the wherewithal, who lives in Virginia, is supposed to be hiring attorneys to do all these things for all these years, and because he didn't, the debtor shouldn't have to pay, strikes me as not equitable. And in fact, it took an attorney who was perhaps willing to take the case on a contingent fee basis in order to move the matter forward at all. But we don't want to get into the facts. If you look at the summary judgment papers, the parties have had plenty of time to do discovery and to introduce all of the arguments they want. There is no argument of financial hardship as such. There's no argument that I didn't plan. There's no argument that I would have done this. That's simply not in the record. That's attorney argument. The only thing that's in the summary judgment papers and the supplemental briefs and the supplemental discovery that was submitted is that interest is unfair because it's so large. It's $620,000. And if there was a concern about ability to pay, the fact that there's a house out there worth $1.7 belies that concern. And so we don't think it's appropriate to send this back for a trial on the issue of all the medical elements and the financial issues that Mr. Williams has allegedly incurred. We don't think that's even part of the analysis here because as a matter of law, interest cannot be prejudicial. And so he never said he couldn't pay it. He said it would be a hardship. And so, we cited to Beatty, which says, and particularly noting that the debtor has the burden of proof here. And he says, where the party has based his latches argument of prejudice almost entirely on a contention that is without legal support and has not, despite ample opportunity, adduced any specific evidence of harm due to the unavailability of evidence or the like, remand for further factual consideration would be futile. It would be inappropriate after discovery has been done and there's been no evidence of anything that was done to change position on finance. I don't want to get into what the discovery has shown, but there's nothing like that out there. The issue is simply, and counsel actually said it, which is it's unfair because of the passage of time and the accrual of interest. And we submit that as a matter of law, it's not, and that therefore the case should be remanded with instructions to enter summary judgment in favor of the appellants.
Thank you.
Any questions?
No.
Well, thank you both for your excellent arguments. This is really interesting. I know that's never comfort the
lawyers to hear the families. It's really interesting, but it is.
As an attorney, I did enjoy the briefing, there's a lot at stake for the
Well, very, very good job. And
it's
under
you,
submission. We'll get your written decision as soon as we can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Okay, our next matter.
The panel took the case under submission at the close of argument. Nothing in oral argument predicts the outcome. The court will issue a written opinion in due course, likely within several months. Whether statutory interest can constitute prejudice for Lash's purposes, and whether summary judgment was appropriate on these facts, are now questions for the judges to resolve in their deliberations.